Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 107 of the Writership Podcast. Today, we're talking about tension. I'm Leslie Watts, here with special guest editor Valerie Francis. To learn more about the podcast, visit writership.com/podcast.
As you know, the Writership Podcast is brought to you by Jim Cookrell of the Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched a new business for nonfiction authors called Business Around a Book. So if you're a nonfiction author, visit www.businessaroundabook.com and let Jim help you turn your nonfiction into a profitable, life-changing business. That's businessaroundabook.com.
Hey, Valerie.
Hello, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for coming again. You were with us in episode 105, and I didn't give you a proper introduction at that time. So I would like to say, at this point, this is Valerie Francis, and she is a best-selling indie author of middle grade fantasy and women's fiction. She's a story editor and a creative entrepreneur. And today, since we're talking about middle grade fiction, I just want to mention your Nature Nights series, which sounds absolutely fantastic. And I want to share also this little bit that you have in your bio that I think is just fantastic. Valerie named her company Fifth Hammer Books, and this is a reference to the myth of Pythagoras and the blacksmith shop, because she believes that the most beautiful art is made and the most important work is done when the rules aren't followed. The fifth hammer is a reminder that the best ideas, like the best stories, work precisely because there is tension. So if you want to learn more about Valerie and how she adds dissonance, you can visit www.valeriefrancis.ca. And we'll have that link in the show notes as well.
Awesome. Thank you, Leslie.
Yes, thank you. So we're talking about tension today, and we have a quote, I understand, about this. We're going to try to stay calm, though, aren't we?
Yes. Are you looking for me to me for the quote?
Sure.
Because I do not have one.
Oh, well.
Other than, hey, you know what? You do. I do have one. You just read it. It's in my bio. The best ideas.
It's pretty good.
Simply because they have tension.
Yeah. Stories you work. The best ones. Yes. Now, I'll just augment that a little with this quote from Saul Bacher. I'm saying that right. Narrative tension is often described as the reason you turn the page. In other words, the reader's desire to know what happens next. So we're going to be diving into that a little more, but I'll leave you with that question about tension. And hopefully you'll want to know what's happening next.
That's right.
Of course, I'm going to relieve that tension for you because we're going to transition to the story. Today's submission is called The Arctic Compass, and it's by Ryan Gannon. We're in middle grade fiction today. The word count is 35,000, and we have the first 5 pages of the story. So thank you so much, Ryan, for your submission. And Valerie is going to read our section for today.
All right, you ready?
Ready.
Okay, this is The Arctic Compass, Chapter 1, by Ryan Gannon. Duncan Hall anxiously knocked on the door to his grandfather's brownstone. When the door opened, Duncan quickly hugged his grandfather, Atticus. Hi, Grandpa. We're going to find Santa this year. I can feel it, Duncan said as he ran to the study. Duncan's parents and sisters stretched from the moderately long driveway into the city before greeting Atticus. The old-timer echoed The old-timer echoed from the stoop, addressing the family. Most 10-year-olds have given up on Santa, but not my grandson. I won't let the fact that Santa hasn't shown up the last 5 years bring this family down. Merry Christmas. Duncan was set on finding a unique, maybe even magical record his grandfather inherited years ago during his cabin building days. Duncan stepped on a stool in front of an enormous wall of books and maps. He reached for a photo album on his tippy toes. The stool began to wobble and slid from under him. Duncan leapt and grabbed the spine of the album. He landed smoothly, narrowly avoiding a nasty tumble. "That was close," he said, and knelt in an athletic pose. Duncan pulled the special handkerchief his grandfather gave him a few years back out of his pocket. The velvety forest green cloth had light specks of silver and danced on the material. Duncan laid the handkerchief on the desk next to the album and placed a sketch of the attic on the opposite side. "Duncan, my boy, you're a little older, a little taller, and a little wiser this year." "Well, maybe not wiser," Atticus exclaimed, seeing the knocked-over stool when he entered the study. Duncan rolled his eyes sarcastically before the two shared in a good laugh. Atticus stood next to Duncan and pulled a raggedy pair of glasses from his shirt pocket before examining the drawing. "What about that corner there? Did you make it that far last year? Is it even possible to get to that section? Oh, I'm embarrassed at the condition of the attic. There's so much clutter up there, I don't know if we'll ever find that darn record." Duncan circled a tiny string that dangled from the only light bulb in the sketch. "He couldn't quite reach the string last year." Atticus smiled while Duncan recounted his missteps. "I finally made my way through the clutter and to the light bulb. I couldn't reach it. This year is different. I won't let that string stand in my way. Plus, I brought a flashlight this year." Atticus laughed as Duncan held the small flashlight high above his head. "Atticus, the girls are eating your signature gourmet cupcakes before dinner. You'd better get in here before the entire plate is gone," Duncan's father shouted from the kitchen. Atticus stood up tall and said, "I'd better check on the family, or there might not be any left for us." He rubbed Duncan's head like only a grandfather could, then left the room. Duncan made his way to the top floor where the attic door was located. He admired the beautiful door frame marked with a large A his grandfather branded on every project he completed. Duncan opened the door slowly. He walked up the small set of steps leading to the attic and stared at a short string in the middle of the room connected to a light bulb. The light from the narrow hallway lit a very small portion of the entrance. Boxes, desks, knick-knacks, and rugs cluttered the attic, making it difficult to reach the string. He pulled a small flashlight from his pocket and placed it in his mouth before maneuvering over and around stacks of boxes. Each time he conquered an obstacle, he would quickly find a new degree of clutter. Duncan climbed on the desk positioned under the light bulb string, but he couldn't quite reach it. He stacked several mismatched cabinet drawers on top of each other. A bead of sweat fell from his brow and landed on the desk as he began to climb. The stack swayed just a little as Duncan reached the top and snagged the string. The light bulb lit up for a brief second before blowing out. This startled Duncan, causing him to lose his balance. The awkward tower of stacked drawers swayed back and forth. The room was dark once again as the tiny light in his mouth moved in every direction like a broken lighthouse, as he tried to regain control. This momentum catapulted him against a wall. The flashlight in his mouth fell to the floor and shined on a large staff, shaped like a candy cane. The staff fell and hit a small table positioned in the corner of the attic. The curve of the staff snagged the blanket covering the table and pulled it to the ground. Duncan collected himself as he wiggled his fingers and toes. He picked up the flashlight and pointed it towards the table. His heart pounded both from the fall and what he was seeing on the table. It was an old-time record player, and it had a record already on it. Duncan shifted to his knees and, while doing so, nudged the staff into one of the legs of the table. A small light blue glow hovered over the record as it spun faster and faster. The record needle nestled tightly in the grooves of the record. Snowflakes swirled in a tight circle. The snowflakes swirled faster and faster, eventually forming the shape of a globe that hovered centimeters above the record. The blue hue from the image lit Duncan's face. A song began to play. Jingle bells, jingle all the way. 45 north, 73 west, that's where Santa stays. A small sleigh and reindeer circled the globe, landing on a star that marked the coordinates. Duncan pulled out the small notepad he kept in his back pocket and jotted down the information. The tree record slowed down the snowflakes, and the light disappeared. He sat for a moment and attempted to take in what he had just seen. Duncan picked himself up and made his way back to the attic door. He sprinted downstairs and shouted for Atticus. A map! I need a map! Duncan entered Atticus's study. Where's a map? What's all this commotion about, Duncan? Atticus asked, entering the study. Duncan searched the wall of books up and down, desperate to find a map of the globe. The tree record! I was in the attic. I found it. It gave me coordinates. Atticus slowly processed the information and said, Coordinates? Coordinates to what? He walked over to the wall of books and pulled down a world atlas. Atticus placed the book on the desk behind him, saying, You found the tree record, and it gave you coordinates? I think these are the coordinates to the cabin you built for Mr. Comet. Do they sound familiar? Does any of this ring a bell, Grandpa? Duncan asked energetically while thumbing through the pages. Atticus rubbed his chin and tried to remember the encounter years ago. You know, Duncan, now that I think about it, I never saw how to get to that cabin. Mr. Comet's associate shared some homemade eggnog with me here in the city. They were pretty insistent that we meet in the city and drive to the build site. I entered the van and became very sleepy. I didn't think much of it then, but golly, I must have been asleep for hours. Atticus reached for the photo album Duncan pulled down earlier and removed a photo. He continued, When I woke up, it was nighttime. I camped in a makeshift cabin they provided for the entire build. Food and supplies were brought in and dropped off by Mr. Comet's associates. Interesting. I suppose all that does sound a little suspicious now that I think about it. When the cabin was finished, Mr. Comet and I celebrated by toasting champagne and took this photo. I was paid and given the unique handkerchief I gave to you and a record made of a cut tree ring. The gifts were so odd, I think I just dismissed them altogether. As I sat in the van to return to the city, the same thing happened. I rested my head on the seat and fell asleep. Next thing I knew, I was being dropped off here at the brownstone, and I never saw or heard from Mr. Comet again. Atticus had a concerned look on his face. He hadn't thought about the specifics of that cabin build in years. He told the story to Duncan often, but he never thought about the strange happenings. Duncan placed the notepad containing the coordinates on the atlas. He traced the north coordinate and the west coordinate. They intersected at Frost Lake. Frost Lake? Atticus yelped. That has to be a 3-day car ride from here. Was I asleep for 3 days? This is getting peculiar, Duncan. Duncan made some notes and said, This is it, Grandpa. This is Santa's cabin. I know it. I just know it. He closed the atlas and returned the notepad to his pocket. Atticus opened a drawer in his desk and pulled out a stack of maps from his cabin building days. Now, I'm not encouraging you to go on this journey, he winked dramatically, but if you were to go, I would want you to have the right materials and connections so you stay safe and don't get lost. Duncan's dad yelled from the living room, Duncan, if you're not going to eat dinner, then it's time to go to bed. Atticus pulled a phone list from the pile of maps and said cautiously, I still have some friends in that part of the far north. You should get some rest and really think about whether you want to do this. Let me know your decision in the morning and I'll make all the necessary arrangements. I want Santa back just as much as you. We must consider the possibility that you found the record for these coordinates at this time and place for a reason. Go and try to sleep, but don't be afraid to dream about the extraordinary. So many questions filled Duncan's head as he prepared for bed. Why hadn't he found the record a few years ago? Why now? Where has Santa been? He lay on top of a blown-up mattress in the living room next to the Christmas tree. The lights brought some calm to his racing heart. A soft snow had begun behind frosted windows. Duncan was now tasked with his first challenge, trying to fall asleep. This proved difficult, knowing that tomorrow the adventure of a lifetime would begin, and his life would never be the same. All he cared about was finding Santa and restoring Christmas before it was too late.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Wow. So we have a somewhat fantastical tale. And you know, we were talking earlier about what a great premise this is. Because it's timely every year, which is awesome.
Christmas stories never get old. You know, every Christmas people are looking for another take on the Santa myth. You know, some new way of looking at it, and something that's fresh and new. And these are the types of stories that we reread year after year after year. So they're great.
Yeah, yeah. And I particularly liked, there's this moment that to me, it sounded like a Rube Goldberg contraption when Duncan was, you know, he had the flashlight in his mouth, but then it fell and it shined on a large staff that was shaped like a candy cane. And then the staff fell and it hit a small table. And it just like that image of, you know, thing to thing to thing made me, it called to mind a Rube Goldberg machine. And that was really fun in the midst of his adventure there in the attic.
Absolutely.
So when we were talking about this, we noted that the author was concerned about tension. And so we've kind of focused on that today. And so I wonder, you know, like we were talking about one, you know, one way to guarantee that you have enough tension is to follow the five commandments of story that we talked about in episode 105 when you were here. And that's the inciting incident, progressive complications, crisis question, climax, and resolution. And that, you know, those are the components of a scene. They're also the components of the story and the acts and all of that, like a fractal. But so let's talk about how this scene does with those five commandments.
Okay. Well, with every, you know, as I mentioned to you earlier, my thought is that writing for children is no different than writing for adults. Mm-hmm. You know, the in terms of the way you approach a story, in terms of the craft, and what the author's challenge in every book is to grab the reader right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Sentence one, paragraph one. And, you know, depending on the audience, that challenge can be different for different reasons. With kids in middle grades, so that would be grades five and six, the competition is not another book. The competition for the kids' attention is, you know, their iPad, their iPhone, their video games, Netflix, and so forth. So it's even more important to reach out from the book and grab the audience right by the shirt and pull them into the book really quickly. And the way we do that, you know, this is why we have these five commandments. This is why these are articulated for us, because if you follow them, then that creates tension. And part of that is, well, the inciting incident, for example, that's got to be something that knocks the protagonist's life out of balance. Mm-hmm. And then you have progressive complications. And the whole point of a complication is that it makes it harder and harder for the main character to get the thing that he wants. So if what Duncan wants is to find Santa, and if there's nothing standing in his way between wanting to find Santa and finding Santa, the reader is not going to keep reading, because it's the thing that it's the conflict and it's the complications that make a story really interesting. That's the thing that makes the reader say, I wonder what's going to happen next. I wonder how he's going to do it. And Andrew Stanton from Pixar, there's a great YouTube video with him. He's doing a TED Talk, and he talks about, I think he calls it the rule of 2+2. Mm-hmm. And what he means is, give a reader 2+2. Don't give him 4. So give them everything they need, but make them add it up themselves, because that's why we read books. We're sort of hardwired to be curious and to have a puzzle that we want to figure out. So that's a really good way of creating tension.
Yeah. So I want to, I'll share the link for that video, because it's an excellent video, in the show notes. And I want to take just a quick step back, because we do have these five components of, you know, or the five commandments of story that we get from the story grid. But there's another way to kind of break down tension. And that comes from an article by the author of our second quote today, Saul Botcher. And I'll share the link for the two articles on this. But in brief, we have the components of tension are anticipation. So something's going to happen, something interesting, and we have to reveal that to the reader. Then there has to be uncertainty. So an open question, a lack of closure about something. And that can be the outcome. It can be the method. It can be a decision. It can be the consequences, but something we need to be wondering about. And then the third component is an investment, so that we care about the result, so that the reader, I should say, cares about the result and wants to stay in there until the character figures that out. And so here we have, you know, there are a few things that are kind of, you know, we know he wants to find this record. We know that the attic is full of stuff. But at bottom, we're not really getting true obstacles, progressive complications. You know, he wants the record, so we have a want. We're not exactly sure what that's going to give him, but he wants that. And we don't know. It happens so quickly, the want and the and his acquiring it, that, and there's not really much that stands in his way.
Yeah, exactly. So what grabs a reader's attention is when we know what the character wants and we know why he wants it. Mm-hmm. So which means, what's at stake? What happens if the character doesn't get what he wants? What will happen? Will it be Armageddon?
Right.
You know, or will there be no consequences? Because there have to be consequences. There has to be conflict. That is what creates tension.
Yeah, and we get this at the last line of this chapter is, all he cared about, meaning Duncan, all he cared about was finding Santa and restoring Christmas before it was too late. But that is coming at the end. Mm-hmm. You know, so we don't have a sense of what's at stake and what, you know, like exactly what happens. So, you know, what happens, what will the consequences be exactly if he doesn't find the record? Otherwise, it's, you know, it's a boy going into an attic and looking for stuff, and it's not as gripping as this boy has to find this record because it will help him, he thinks, maybe find Santa, and he needs to find Santa because, you know, there's the suggestion of a ticking clock at the end, but we don't know the nature of it. And that doesn't all have to be revealed, as in, you know, and we'll talk about that in a minute, about holding back information. But we need to have a sense of what's at stake for Duncan in going forward, and then for it to be tough for him, which is hard, especially when you're writing about a younger character. But I was hoping, Valerie, that you would speak to your that you would speak about your visits, your to your classroom visits and how the kids respond and the way it's different from, say, an adult reading.
Absolutely. I do a lot of classroom visits, primarily grade five, although I do grade six as well. And they're a hoot and a half. I just love doing them. And the thing I love most about reading for kids and writing for kids is that if they don't like it, you know right away. It is instant and honest feedback. And if they have questions, they're going to ask them right away. So one great way when you're writing for kids, if you're wondering whether you've created tension, read to a bunch of kids. If you can go into a classroom, or if there are children in your neighborhood or in your life somehow, that you can sort of gather them together and read what you've written to them and see what their reaction is. If they are sort of sitting there scratching their head and saying, yeah, I don't get it, then you've missed something. If their attention has wandered away, and kids, if you haven't gotten their attention, kids will physically wander away.
Mm-hmm.
It's great fun. It's great. One literacy day, I read to an entire school. I spent the full day reading class by class. And, you know you have the children when they, because they were, the kids were sitting on the floor and I was standing in front of them. The kids would start inching toward you.
Oh.
I thought, okay, I got them. They're inching toward me. By the time I got to the end of my reading, some of them were touching my toes. They had come that close. And I thought, I got them. Woohoo, I got them. So, you know, adults don't do that. Mm-hmm. Adults are so concerned with hurting your feelings that even if what you've written doesn't work, they will tell you, oh, yeah, it sounds good. And you might finish the conversation thinking that what you'd written has worked, but it really hasn't. And, you know, the adult wouldn't have bought the book and probably wouldn't read to the end, but they don't want to say that. Whereas kids will say it instantly and they will call you out if something isn't working. And the other thing that will happen in a classroom setting and when you deal directly with kids is that if they get the sense that you, the adult, the sage, all-knowing adult, has wandered in there to tell them how it is and to teach them a lesson and to say, you know, not exactly these words, but essentially say, okay, now boys and girls, all of you sit down and I'm going to tell you a story and teach you a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
There are stories that do that and they're called parables and they're important. Novels, however, they do teach lessons, but the lessons are called themes as opposed to a black and white lesson. Here's what you do, here's what you don't do. And there's a huge difference between a parable and a novel. And I always use Harry Potter as an example. There's lots of great stories out there, but Harry Potter is a story that just about everyone knows. You've either read the books or seen the movie or you just know the premise of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be spoiler alerts.
Oh, spoiler alert.
If there is anyone listening who has not heard of Harry Potter yet or read the books, well, you know, I'm sorry.
Come back so, later. Go watch it now and come back later.
That's right. In an interview with J.K. Rowling, she said that she reworked the first chapter of the first book of Harry Potter 15 times.
Oof.
I know.
Yeah.
And the reason is because she kept giving too much away. And she said if you read her very first draft of chapter one, you would know right from the first chapter that Harry himself is a Horcrux. Now, the way the series unfolds, we don't learn that until the very end of the story because we don't need to know that. And the reader is on a need-to-know basis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If the reader doesn't need to know a piece of information, don't tell him. Make him work for it. Because if there's missing pieces of information, that creates tension. That makes the reader keep reading to say, okay, well, what's going to happen next? What's this about? You mean there are seven Horcruxes? Well, where are they? How do we find them? What is this? That's been the secret to Voldemort's power all along. You know, and this is why you just sort of give him a little teaspoon of information at a time, and drag it out, and drag it out, and string them along, because that's what readers want. Everyone, I don't care what age they are, they want to pick up a book and get lost in the story and be so lost in it and so compelled by it that they can't put it down. And that's the way you do it. It sounds a lot easier when I say it like that than it actually is.
Yeah, yeah. But it's what we, you know, what we keep working for, and what, you know, what J.K. Rowling was doing in those 15 drafts, you know, gradually going through and pulling out. And, oh, there's a great exercise. I think it's a writing excuses exercise, I want to say. And I'll try to find the link for this. But it's where you take out details in a scene until you break it, essentially. And then you put back only what is absolutely necessary. And that's a really brief summary of that exercise. But the point is that you want to look at the scene and what is a little clue or a little breadcrumb that you can give the reader that makes them wonder, and then absolutely keep all the rest. So, you know, so that you're using that in a powerful way. And one of the ways I described this recently is that you want to withhold it, you know, that idea of ammunition or exposition as ammunition. You want to withhold it until the revelation of a particular piece of information can be its most powerful, that'll have the most impact on the character and his pursuit of the goal. And if absolutely you do that, like if you do that, if you hold it until that moment, it's like it'll be memorable, first of all, because mm-hmm if we just give the reader a bunch of information, it's hard to hold it all. We don't know what's significant, and we don't have a good filter at the beginning of a story to be able to sort through all the facts and know what's important and what's not. So when we do it in a powerful way like that, the reader will remember it. And it also creates a turning point in the scene where it's revealed, because it changes everything. And so, and you know, it won't always be earth shaking, like I'm making it sound, but it will be a lot more powerful than these are the facts about this.
That's right. And in this draft, there's loads of opportunity for the author to go back and take out information and hold on to it until we need to know. Like, for example, in the second paragraph, we find out that Duncan still believes in Santa, mm-hmm, and that Santa hasn't shown up the last 5 years. Well, we don't need to know that right off the bat, because that's just told to us. That can be shown to us later. That can be revealed, just as you're talking about. We also find out that Duncan was set on finding a unique, maybe even magical record. We don't need to be told that it's magical. We can be that. The fact that there is magic can be revealed a little bit later on, even in this scene. Mm-hmm. But that'll make us turn the page, or that'll make us wonder about this record. That'll have the audience asking themselves questions about why does he want to find this record? And there's a record made out of a tree trunk. How does that work? Rather than telling us in paragraph 3 that it's magical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Because then we're not wondering about it anymore. Okay, so there's a magical record, and he found the magical record, and it was magical.
Right? Right. Yeah.
So there's lots of opportunity, and it's a very meaty chapter. I mean, there's lots of stuff going on in there.
Mm-hmm.
And my main recommendation would be to hold most of it back.
Yeah, hold back the information, and then dial up the obstacles. So make it so that, like, you know, maybe that. And I'm just going to throw out a few examples just to, you know, obviously the author will be able to come up with much better ones. But something like the door to the attic is locked and they can't find the key, or the, you know, he does have the problem of the light switch, but, or, you know, pulling the string on the light, but an adult could come do that. But what if for some reason the, you know, the fuse had blown and there's no, of course we have breakers now, but say the fuse had blown and there are no fresh fuses in, you know, in grandpa's workshop, or, you know, so that kind of thing. And that creates like a sort of side mission that now he has this goal. He wants to find the record, but he's got to deal with these complications that come up and get progressively worse. And so we're like always wondering, is he going to find it? Is he not going to find it? And we, you know, and again, like we care about it because we know why he needs it. And so that is just kind of, that'll just, you know, as you say, grab us by the front of the shirt and pull us deeply into those stories. Because the fact is, as you mentioned, that, you know, these stories are so rich. And I loved the way that you described this earlier, because this is a hard time in childhood. It's not actually, it's beyond childhood. But, you know, the point is you're on the cusp of becoming a teenager, you know, and that, you know, are you a little kid or are you a teenager? And that when you're on those, when you're standing on the cusp of those big changes that are mental and physical and emotional and hormonal, that you know, like that's just fraught with angst. I have to say I'm in the middle of this right now. I have a fifth going into sixth grader, and so we're swimming in these waters. So it's very present and immediate for me.
Yes. Nothing like hormones to add a bit of conflict. Yes.
Oh man. Yeah, and so I think that. That's what makes these stories so rich and why we just love them, because those poor kids, we know that they're really in for it and they don't know exactly what's going on. And they feel like they wake up every day with a different brain and they don't have as much autonomy as they will eventually have. So they don't have control. And anyway, I really feel for them. And of course, the parents who get to, and other adults who get to ride those waves too. So
yes, and stories, and another point that we talked about: stories are about conflict. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what makes them interesting. Mm-hmm. Because if everyone agrees that they need a certain thing, and everyone works harmoniously to get that certain thing, mm-hmm. from page one to the end, that's a really dull story. So we need to have characters who disagree with one another. We need to have characters who get in one another's way. You know, like Duncan wants to find Santa. I want to know why he wants to find Santa, and I want to know what's in the way, what's getting in his way of finding Santa. Because mm-hmm. there's nothing in this chapter that has gotten in his way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another thing that we sort of chatted a bit about for kids fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The adults are always a problem because... that's why so many protagonists in middle grade books are orphans, because
mm-hmm.
you just get rid of the adults
right
away. Or like in Harry Potter, they go away to boarding school, that kind of stuff. You got to get away from the parents,
yeah.
And the adults. So when Duncan's grandfather says, you know, I'll set you up with everything you need, it's great if Duncan has an ally. Right?
Sure.
And he needs one. He needs a mentor and a teacher, and that can very well be his grandfather. There's no problem with that. But I kind of wondered, given that this is a Christmas story, how's the author going to explain Duncan going away, a 10-year-old, by himself?
Mm-hmm.
Because his parents are going to wonder where he is.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, for example, Santa Claus can cover the globe in one night, in our time.
Mm-hmm.
Is this story, and I only have the first chapter, so maybe this is revealed a little further on, mm-hmm. but something that I'm curious about is, does this story involve a difference of time where Duncan can go on his adventure, and the adventure might take, I don't know, say 2 or 3 weeks for him actually to do the thing.
Right.
But in our time, it's really only a night. Just mm-hmm. the way Santa delivers gifts. In our time, it's only one night,
mm-hmm.
but what is it in Santa Claus time?
Right.
In the magical world time. Because there has to be a way to deal with that. Because yeah. if you were to read this in front of a middle grade, that is the type of thing that the kids will pick up on. Oh, yeah? He's going away? Great. What's his mother going to say? She's not going to let him out of the house. Because that is the type, that's the world they live in, where the kids are constantly wanting to do things and are told they can't do things
mm-hmm.
because they have to get past the parents. The parents are the gatekeeper, or parents or guardians are the gatekeeper to the kid wanting them to do what they want to do. And lots of times it is the grandparent who lets the kid do the thing that the parents won't let them do. So
right.
that's totally plausible that grandpa is the one who's going to help him go on the adventure. And I'm cool with that, but it needs to be a little harder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He cannot set out with everything that he needs, because then where's the conflict going to come? Like for example, when he had the flashlight. Well, there was a light bulb in the attic. Why would you bring a flashlight if mm-hmm. there's a light bulb? You wouldn't, right? So if
yeah.
you get up there and you turn on the light, and maybe the cord is rotten and the cord breaks, or the light goes out, like you said, or there's a power outage,
mm-hmm.
then he's in the dark. Now you got conflict.
Yeah.
Now you have an obstacle between Duncan needing something and getting what he needs.
Mm-hmm.
Or wanting something and getting what he wants.
And then he's got to try to maybe go find the flashlight or something. It's, yeah, and I want to make sure that that's right, that it's clear that all of the elements really are present,
mm-hmm, and absolutely.
And that it's just a matter of like tweaking the parts and like, you know, making it. And it's hard to make things hard for characters, especially, you know, I haven't written middle grade fiction, but if I did, I'm sure that it would be, you know, there would be parts of my own children in it and parts of my own experience, and that it would feel very vulnerable, and that I would really want to take care of that character and not see them put through so much. And in that way, like, it would be really hard to push them and make them deal with all these bad things. But those are the things that really help us, you know, when it comes to story and what helps us get through tough times in life generally. And especially like this time, it's so important for kids to have good stories that can get them through when they don't feel comfortable talking to an adult or, you know, appearing vulnerable in front of their friends and that kind of thing. So that we have these elements, but we want to just tweak them to make it hard for Duncan. So he really has to work, because, right, these first obstacles that he faces and overcomes will be the thing that builds him up for the final obstacles that he will need to face at the, you know, at the ultimate climax of the book. And so we want to make sure that he has earned the right to be successful at the end.
Totally. Duncan has to earn it. That's
yeah.
exactly the point.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a parent, you know, I mentioned here earlier, I have a son who's you know, getting ready to go off to college, and the mother in me just wants to wrap him in bubble wrap and keep him very safe from all the things in the world that are going to be dangerous. That's the mom in me. The author in me says, this is material. This is reference. You know, I don't want to see anything bad happen to anyone. But
right.
the truth is, bad things do happen. And that's what makes, it's those challenges and those struggles that makes us grow as people. And that's what makes your character grow. And that is more, that is even more important, I think, in middle grade. Well, it's important in all books, but in middle grade and in kids' books, children don't have, for the most part, points of reference for life yet. They don't have a lot of experience.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes they're getting experience with the difficulties of life through books. And I always when I'm talking to authors, encourage them to make it complicated, make it hard, because you're not the parent of the character, you're the author of the character. So the job is very, very different. And a lot of kids, your audience, are going through difficult stuff. You know, their parents could be divorcing, or there could be a loss in the family, or there could be, you know, they could be getting bullied, or, you know, like all these types of challenges. The kids are not, they're not inexperienced in conflict. They're inexperienced in how to deal with the conflict. And so that's where books become even more important, because they can see how the characters deal with conflict, and that sort of teaches them, it gives them a point of reference as to how they can behave when that happens to them in their life, at whatever stage it happens.
Yeah, well said.
Meaty stuff, huh?
Yeah, it is meaty. It is so, you know, you think, oh, middle grade, it's so soft. No, it's not.
No, no, and you know what? If you make it too soft, you will lose the kids.
Yeah.
You know, because of their point of reference.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to read about characters that are too goody-goody. And really, as an author, when you're developing a character, the character has to have a flaw. There has to be something about that character that isn't so great.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what adds to the conflict. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's about the conflict.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I have an editorial mission for us this week. Just happened to have one. And it is check for tension. So tension is that vehicle that pulls the reader through your story. So, and when people talk about tension, you know, we talk about conflict, we talk about stakes, we talk about pacing, and these are all important. And another way to think about it is, as Saul Botcher said, that we have anticipation, we have uncertainty, and we have investment. So this week, look at your opening scene in particular. Now, you can use this for all of your scenes, but you know, it's so important in the opening scene that you grab the reader and really pull them in. So look at your scene and see, have you set up the possibility that something interesting is going to happen? And have you left room for uncertainty? So we don't know if the character is going to get what they want, or we don't know, it's not certain that things will unfold in a particular way, or that that interesting thing will happen in a certain way. And is there an open question in the reader's mind? And then have you added reasons for the reader to care about that, about what happens, about the outcome, so that they keep reading to find out what happens? And so if you're lacking any of those elements in your opening scene, add those in, add obstacles, add that, you know, make sure that we understand the stakes. You know, what, why is the character doing this, and what are, will the consequences be if he's not successful? And really, you know, do it more than, I want to say, do it more than you think you have to, because you can always, it's easier to dial back than to dial up, I think. Maybe for some people it's not, but so that's the mission for the week. And a special reminder that you can go to writership.com/episodes to sign up and get those editorial missions delivered right to your inbox, which is a great solution if you're on the go normally when you're listening.
And remember, the Writership Podcast is brought to you by Jim Cookrell and the Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched a new business for nonfiction authors called Business Around a Book. So if you're a nonfiction author, visit www.businessaroundabook.com and let Jim help you turn your nonfiction book into a profitable, life-changing business. That's businessaroundabook.com.
All right, before we go, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. If you want to have your five pages reviewed, please visit writership.com/submissions. And finally, be sure to check out episodes of The Book Editor Show, which Clark hosts with Peter Turley. That's it for episode 107. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.